Good morning, and I'm so glad you were able to stay for the whole APHA conference and come to this presentation. My name is Janet Schneiderman, and I'm going to present a descriptive analysis of my colleague Penny Trickert's longitudinal study on the effects of maltreatment on adolescent development. This research that I'm presenting has been published in Child Abuse and Neglect just in the last month or two, and it's online, so I put in the information so you can find it. And I have no relationships to disclose. Just some background statistics. There are 3.7 million children referred to Child Protective Services, and 9.1% are confirmed as experiencing sexual abuse. And the NIS-4, which is the fourth national incidence study of child abuse and neglect, found that girls are sexually abused 3.8 times more often than boys. Much of the research on childhood sexual abuse includes two types of studies: follow-up with children identified as sexually abused by protective services, which is the information that I'm going to present, and also retrospective studies that ask individuals to recall sexual abuse experiences earlier in childhood and correlate them to current functioning. The difference is that the CPS definitions are often, or Child Protective Service definitions, are often much more standardized than the retrospective studies. And that's because the questions that they ask on retrospective studies about sexual abuse include such questions as, have you had any unwanted sexual advances? Have you ever been sexually abused? Have you been forced or somewhat forced into a sexual experience? Have you had penetration or genital contact more than 10 times? The wide variation in how the questions are asked, both between and within studies, make it a little bit more difficult to compare those studies to other studies. So we used child welfare records to look at sexual abuse for this study. In our review of the records, we only found sexual assault and not sexual exploitation. The children who were exposed to sexual exploitation are usually in Los Angeles, where this study takes place, sent to juvenile court as opposed to child welfare. And if any of you went to the the session on sexual exploitation, you probably will remember that. In terms of the effects of childhood sexual abuse, there's lots of inconsistent findings, but generally we find that childhood sexual abuse affects the mental and physical health, risk-taking, a lot of sexual risk-taking, drug use, and cognitive abilities, and health, including obesity of children who have been exposed. Most studies found that abuse by a father or father figure is the most detrimental to long-term consequences, and penetrative sexual abuse has a higher risk for mental health problems than non-penetrative or non-contact abuse. The purpose of this study, which was a longitudinal study of children reported to the Los Angeles County DCFS for any type of maltreatment, was to compare the demographics of maltreated youth initially labeled as sexually abused by the child welfare system to maltreated youth classified as sexually abused using current and past case records. We looked at 4 years, which is all the records that they had, of past contact with child welfare to look at all types of maltreatment, but I'm going to talk specifically about sexual abuse. Identify differences in sexual abuse experiences and types of perpetrators between boys and girls, and we provided a detailed description of the sexual abuse experiences of these victims. The parent study, children were qualified to participate if there was a newly substantiated maltreatment referral to DCFS in the preceding month for any type of maltreatment. They were young adolescents because it was a longitudinal study that looked at four waves of data between age 9 and 22, and so the time at which this occurred was between 9 to 12 years old. The child was identified as Latino or African-American or Caucasian non-Latino, and they were in 10 zip codes in the south central part of Los Angeles, and we had 303 subjects with maltreatment, and of the families that were approached, 77% agreed. These are kids both in foster care and who remain at home. Los Angeles, if you might not be aware, is the largest local child welfare agency in the United States. Only Illinois, the state of Illinois, is bigger. We developed a maltreatment case records abstraction system, and we utilized retired child welfare workers to actually go through the records. They were paper files at that time of these 303 children, identifying any type of maltreatment that was investigated by the child welfare system. We used 4 years of previous records. We did not use the severity system of rating. We just used descriptive statistics, and the reliability of the coding by graduate students was quite high for all types of abuse. This abstraction system, which was descriptive, was based on the maltreatment classification system by Barnett, Manley, and Cicchetti, and the LongScan modified maltreatment system. These were the McRae, which is the abstraction system, the way we called it. These are the types of maltreatment. The usual of sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and physical abuse. I don't know why that's twice. It shouldn't be. there was caretaker incapacity, which meant that the child was reported to DCFS because the caretaker couldn't take care of them, either due to hospitalization, unknown whereabouts, or incarceration. And caretaker's inability to provide care, which included caretaker's mental illness, substance use, or physical illness. We also had a substantial risk category, which included when there was no clear allegation in the case records, but the sibling was abused, and that put the child at risk. Our analysis was not as sophisticated as the last person. It was just a descriptive analysis of the type of perpetrators. They were split by gender and categorized as biological parent, parental figure, relative, and unrelated. We characterized the child's sexual abuse experiences as penetrative abuse, contact without penetration, and non-contact. And we used simple chi-square or Fisher's exact test to see if there were statistical differences in the characteristics by gender and by gender of the perpetrator and gender of the youth. This is a description of the DCFS initial report. So this is just when they came into the study compared to our McRae categorization, our complete look at their 4 years of previous records. We had the average age of onset for the McRae analysis for the first sexual abuse experience was 8.1 years old, but there were no differences in ethnicity, placement, gender our age at entry into the study between the McRae sexually abused kids and the kids who were came into the study who were identified as by DCFS as being sexually abused. One of the things that we really was striking was the polyvictimization of these children, in the sense that the kids that came in, identified by DCFS as sexually abused when they came in the study, had very few other types of maltreatment. And over 50% of the kids, when we looked at past records, had other types of maltreatment indicated. These are the abuse types. Non-penetrative contact was the most likely, although 40% of the children that were categorized as sexually abused by McRae had penetration as their type of sexual abuse. And the number in each of the main categories of non-contact and non-penetrative contact and penetrative contact included the number of youth who experienced that abuse one time. So many children had more than one type of sexual abuse. Youth in each category within the three main categories could have experienced more than one type. Non-contact included kids who were exposed to adults engaging in sexual activity, such as oral sex or vaginal intercourse, or adults masturbating. Contact including fondling of the breasts, which was only for female children, buttocks, or general reference to inappropriate sexual contact, touching. And the most common was non-penetrative contact or non-penetrative contact and penetration. These were the perpetrator types. This is the only statistical difference that we found. Most youth were victimized by a male perpetrator, and one-fifth were abused by a female perpetrator. Girls were significantly less likely than boys to be abused by women, p.002. Father figures included step-parents or parents live-in romantic partners. Related male perpetrators included siblings, uncles, and cousins. Unrelated male perpetrators included non-live-in romantic partners of the parents, other youth, a parent's co-worker, a school bus driver, older siblings, friends, romantic partners of relatives, and neighbors. The unrelated female perpetrator was a sister, and unrelated female the related female perpetrator was a sister, but the unrelated female perpetrator included an adolescent friend, another foster child, and another child. The range of sexual acts which we found when we looked at the records was quite broad. For biological fathers and father figures on female youth, it usually included penetration. Female perpetrators almost never penetrated youth of either gender, and biological mothers most often exposed youth to sexual activity or pornography rather than touching the child. Male relatives and unrelated males had the greatest range of types of abuse for both genders. The main issue that we found is that when you either do research about childhood sexual abuse or you are doing interventions for children, is that if you only use one record, you're really missing a lot of their experiences. Because there were only 23 youth that were identified by DCFS when they came into this study, and we found 60 youth who actually had sexual abuse in their history. and that's a really big difference. And it's been showing up in all of our longitudinal studies of mental health outcomes, physical health outcomes, etc. If we had not actually abstracted their records, we would not have found those differences. Also, the specifics of their sexual abuse history is important because there are differences in terms of how they experience their sexual abuse and the developmental consequences. For us, we found a lack of gender differences in child sexual experiences. That isn't the case for other studies, and here's a comparison to some other studies. Very similar to the NIS-4, most of our victims were, the perpetrator was male, and most often, about 30% were the biological parent. Biological mothers were the most common type of perpetrator. The differences was one of the two main differences that we had two times more males than females that were abused, and the NIS-4 found 3.8 times. Sometimes it is that males are not asked about their sexual abuse, or they're less likely to talk about it with a female caseworker or a physician, etc. There was no difference in our study of penetrative abuse by gender, but there was a difference in the NSCA-1, where 50.7% girls versus 41.8 boys had penetrative abuse. And the NSCA-1 is a national study of kids who have been reported for abuse and neglect in the United States. So we did find two differences between our study and other studies. In conclusion, there was a high prevalence of the more severe types of abuse of contact or penetration in this sample. This is a low-income sample, primarily minority, in the central part of Los Angeles, and it has shown effects on their long-term mental health and behavioral trajectories and health. And we urge other researchers as well as clinicians to explore previous experiences with sexual abuse if you're using child welfare records, and not to take the report that you actually get when you first either enter them to your study or service them.